You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
Thank you all for showing up on this hot and humid day on a Friday in Washington for this really excellent panel on a challenging and distressing topic, the issue of ISIS in Iraq, particularly the focus on the latest battle for Fallujah, which drove ISIS out of there. The panel called After Fallujah, Security Governance, and the Next Battle Against ISIS. I'm very happy that this is a collaboration between the Middle East Institute and the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies Conflict Management Program. Dr. Dan Serwer, who runs the program, was supposed to moderate this panel, but he had to travel. I want to thank him for the long cooperation between the MEI and this institute here at SAIS. We have a number of other events coming up in addition to this excellent event I wanted to mention before we get started. On Monday, July 18, we have a book talk with Milton Viorst. Milton is a renowned author, former New Yorker, journalist. His new book is on Zionism, the birth and transformation of an ideal. He looks at the evolution or devolution or the controversy over the last 100 years between the ideals of Zionism and the current occupation and the challenges there. That's Monday, July 18 at 5:30. I urge you to sign up for that if you're here and free. Then on Wednesday, July 27, we have another book sort of talk and a book panel with our Brookings colleague Shadi Hamid, as well as several experts that will join him on a panel to discuss his new book, Islamist Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Check our website at mei.edu. Please sign up for both events if you're free. Today's topic is the fight against ISIS in Iraq, particularly the latest battle for Fallujah. And the challenges for the Iraqi state and society in terms of sustaining this victory, building towards further fights perhaps in Mosul, how to deal with political challenges, refugee challenges, reconciliation, reconstruction, all of that. This battle comes obviously after the battles for Tikrit and Ramadi earlier that were also, they were done in different ways, but they also drove ISIS out of there. ISIS has lost up to 40-45% of its territory in Iraq and seems to be on the defensive there, but still very present in Iraq, very present in Syria. And sadly, as we saw in Nice, there's still a lot of sort of dynamism in the ideology, perhaps in the networks themselves. We have a stellar panel today. They will speak in the order that that you see them here, from my left to my right. And their bios are available in the handouts that you picked up when you came in, but just let me say a few words about each. Jessica Lewis McFate, at the left, to my left on the table, is the Director of Tradecraft and Innovation at the Institute for the Study of War. The Institute, I'm sure you know, excellent work on Iraq and Syria and certainly on many other theaters around the world. She is a former U.S. Army intelligence officer, including deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. She's the author of a number of books and studies on countering ISIS, and we're very thrilled that she's with us today. To my immediate left is Douglas Ollivant, a senior fellow at the Future of War Project at the New America Foundation. He's a retired Army officer and a strategic and a former West Point professor and a senior vice president at a strategic consulting firm. He was director for Iraq at the National Security Council under the Bush and Obama administrations and served two tours in Iraq. Charles Lister, to my right, is at the Middle East Institute. He's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, formerly also at Brookings Doha, author of a recent book called The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency. And is very expert on ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra, and other jihadist groups. To his right, also from MEI, Ambassador Robert Ford. a senior fellow at the Institute. He is known to you. He was the last U.S. ambassador to Syria. He has also served as ambassador to Algeria and served several times in Baghdad, including as deputy ambassador there from 2008 to 2010. We've asked each panelist to make opening remarks of 8 to 9 minutes. Then I might engage them in a few questions of my own, and then we'll turn it over to you for questions or quick comments. We have to stop at 1:30, but I'm sure we'll have ample time to get into the debate. So let's start with Jessica to perhaps give us her views on sort of U.S. coalition strategy, Iraqi strategy, from Fallujah moving forward perhaps to Mosul. Floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everybody. It is a privilege to be here and to participate in such a distinguished panel. I'd like to open with some remarks that place Iraq in context. We are fighting a global war, I would say, against a global strategic actor in ISIS. And it is not the only global actor we need to consider. ISIS is predominantly active within Iraq and Syria, but most certainly not exclusively so. One of the points I'd want to make from the outset is that we could very well succeed at what I think is the present mission we have framed for ourselves, and that is to remove ISIS from all of the cities within Iraq and Syria that it currently occupies, and first, fail to defeat ISIS outright, and second, potentially disrupt ISIS just enough to knock it off of its claim to leadership of the Salafi jihad movement, and potentially set al-Qaeda up for a very significant win. I am very concerned that we are focusing our military efforts upon Iraq and Syria to the exclusion of other places, regionally especially, where ISIS and al-Qaeda are active. So, yes, of course. The first point I would make is that we need to regard the wins, these incredible successes against ISIS that we have enumerated, including the loss of 40 or 45% of its controlled territory, and including the apparent loss of 45% of its Twitter resonance, as not effective metrics to encompass the whole of the strategy that is required to defeat ISIS as a global movement. Now, Iraq in that context, I actually do think that Iraq will remain central to ISIS's campaign for a number of reasons. First, I do think that its military apparatus is fundamentally built upon a Ba'athist legacy, and that that is the land that they know. Similarly, ISIS is obsessed with Dabiq, a place in northern Syria where an apocalyptic battle is to occur. And I don't think that ISIS is going to move off of Iraq and Syria, for example, to establish a permanent caliphate presence in Sirte, Libya, exclusive of Iraq and Syria. I do think that ISIS can potentially bridge what it will view as a temporary loss through such conditions as an attempt at a virtual caliphate, or an attempt at a satellite caliphate that is framed geographically in some remote place within its caliphate framework. But ISIS will intend to reestablish itself physically as a landowner within Iraq and Syria as quickly as possible. Now, speaking about timeframes, I do consider ISIS to be an outgrowth of al-Qaeda in Iraq, a fighting group I had encountered when I was a soldier in Iraq in 2007 and 2008. And that it did not take them very much time. I would say from November 2008, the Battle of Mosul, until the beginning of 2012 to start to demonstrate its force again. That is not a long time. The barriers to ISIS's reentry now are much lower than the barriers to al-Qaeda's resurgence before. So that I do think we need to be thinking very seriously about, as some of my colleagues have mentioned, post-Mosul, post-ISIS, in terms of what barriers are being erected now, not only when it comes to making sure that ISIS and its present configuration cannot return more quickly than it did last time. The Syrian war as a backdrop has most certainly also increased freedom of action for all Salafi jihadist movements, but also for consideration that al-Qaeda might have interest. In fact, our team at ISW does think that al-Qaeda has interest in becoming a landowner in Iraq ultimately. In fact, the al-Qaeda network's framework for regions includes a definition of Sham that has Iraq in it, so that al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, for example, Jabhat al-Nusra, could potentially move into Iraq if ISIS is disrupted just enough to cease to be a global leader from the perspective of its support network. So the mission at hand is, yes, push ISIS out of all of its cities, liberate them, make those vital cities once more, help Iraq reestablish barriers to ISIS's reentry that also apply to al-Qaeda. In that construct, we are doing particularly well at the first task. Not only the fact that we can continue to see ground forces driving ISIS out of cities, most recently Fallujah, but also that we are doing so much more quickly than we used to. Tikrit was a long battle. Ramadi was a very long battle. I was actually personally shocked at how quick the battle for Fallujah was. When I think of Fallujah, I think of Fallujah in 2004. You know, I think of that as an environment in which removing ISIS should have been much harder. Two potential reflections. One of them, that we are getting better at setting conditions so that ISIS is constrained, cannot maintain freedom of action in order to defend the cities the way that it used to. Another potential reflection is that ISIS is selecting when it's going to fight for its cities now, and that it chose not to fight for Fallujah. Both of those assessments can co-occur. So I am both encouraged that the coalition with Iraqi forces at the front are doing better in the fight against ISIS. I am more encouraged that we are more prepared for the Battle of Mosul now than I had been before the Battle of Fallujah. Now, there are some differences. Mosul is not only farther from Baghdad by a considerable degree, but it is a much larger city. I think it is 10 times the size of Fallujah. It's also a much more essential city when it comes to not only the society of Iraq, but to the economy. And it sits along a number of regional seams representing a number of regional interests, such that the coalition that is put together to fight for and secure Mosul is a much more complicated element of the strategy. However, my sense right now is that we do have momentum in that ground fight and that the battle for Mosul is upcoming. I'm very excited for this. My caution is, as I've mentioned before, that ISIS is a fighting group. It is fighting a revolutionary war, and it is making choices about when to fight and when not to, with the expectation that its generational war can afford a lull of 2 to 3 years. And we need to make sure that the gains against ISIS are lasting and that the cities are rebuilt, that societies are allowed to reenter, and that the barriers are genuine. The final point that I will make that is evident also in the Battle of Fallujah, as well as Ramadi and Tikrit, is the concern about the composition of forces on the Iraqi side. The entire Iraqi army is not engaged in this fight. There are especially capable units, particularly the counterterrorism service, that are the lead tip of the spear for these operations. The forces that are left as holding forces in these cities are not necessarily as capable of maintaining security as the forces that are actually clearing them in the first place. There are not enough forces that are capable of clearing to maintain all of the counteroffensives that may potentially be necessary across Iraq. I hope that there are enough to engage in the Battle of Mosul. I suspect that the answer is probably almost enough. But that there will be training of forces, there will be assistance of forces, as well as coalition considerations in order to prepare to actualize the full capacity of the Iraqi security forces to go on the offensive against ISIS, and that there will be very serious considerations about how to incorporate or whether to incorporate the popular mobilization on the offense. Now, the popular mobilization is, in one sense, a positive reflection of ways of organically building more forces to fight against ISIS. They are heavily infiltrated, sometimes led. I think it is fair to say co-opted by Iranian-backed Shia militias, and that it is a concern not only in terms of a separate intent for offensives against ISIS that they would prosecute, but also what they do in the wake of a liberation operation. There are reflections of sectarian violence against populations that we do need to be concerned about. That those reflections are not specifically or exclusively applicable to the places that have been liberated from ISIS. There was a parade in Baghdad this week with a heavy representation of Iranian-backed Shia militias, which is another point I would make about ISIS. It does seem to be popular right now to juxtapose ISIS's spectacular attacks around the world, not only in Europe, but also in Baghdad, with ISIS's loss of cities and loss of Twitter resonance, and interpret that those must be signs of desperation. I don't think so. The spectacular attack capability that ISIS has had in Iraq is a tradition of this organization. It is not even an adaptation. This is a core capability. It's the one that they're leveraging now. They could continue to leverage it smartly. ISIS's bombings in Baghdad and Balad recently are among the most powerful and most lethal bombings that they've ever had. So the group is also still alive and kicking as a terrorist threat to Baghdad, to include threats that actually still have political ramifications. So we do need to be concerned about the defense of Baghdad also against two different threats, with the overarching, and I would close with this, challenge that we need to defeat ISIS in Iraq without hyperinflating and hyperempowering agents that are furthering an Iranian agenda that undermines the U.S.-led anti-ISIS coalition. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jessica. Douglas, let's turn to you. War is the continuation of politics. There was a lot of failure of politics before ISIS took advantage of it a couple of years ago in Iraq. And stabilizing the victories, if they continue, is largely a political challenge. And certainly politics in Iraq is very divided and very strained. Could you share with us some of your views about that?
Sure. Again, it's a great pleasure to be here today and a pleasure to be with such a distinguished panel, almost all of whom I've interacted with before. Iraqi politics has been reshuffled by the events of the last 4 years, primarily, though not exclusively, by the seizure of initially almost a third or just over a third of its territory by the invasion of ISIL. So my pithy phrase that I tell people is trying to understand Iraqi politics through the lens of the Iraqi politics we knew in 2006 or 2008 is like trying to understand today's Republican politics through the lens of the McCain or Romney campaigns.
I was wondering how long it would take to...
Not very. It's there. You can't help but grab it. Yes, there are commonalities, just as, you know, Mr. Trump still has to win 50 states in the Electoral College. So there are some base realities to Iraq that are still there. But a great deal has been reshuffled. And if I was to give you two major takeaways, which I'll now develop in detail, they would be these. First, the intra-sectarian tensions may now be at least as important, if not more important, than the inter-sectarian tensions. We are all very used to, if you followed Iraq at all, hearing about Sunni, Shia, Kurd, and the tensions between those three groups. And that's not to say they are not still there. But I'm going to talk today about Kurd v. Kurd tensions, about Sunni v. Sunni tensions, and about Shia v. Shia tensions, which I think may be more important to understand Iraqi politics over the next year or two. But second, I want to give a brief glimmer of hope in that I see the nascent emergence of some real politics in Iraq, politics happening with a small d democratic, with a small r republican. There are some rays of light coming through the institutions that we set up, that the Americans and the coalition set up in Baghdad, that permit this kind of political dialogue to happen, and I'll touch on this briefly. I'm going to go very, very quickly through the intra-sectarian tensions. Kurd versus Kurd. The ruling Kurdish Democratic Party, the KDP, of President Barzani, and a bunch of other people named Barzani, versus the PUK, led by, it's not clear which Talabani, but a whole bunch of people named Talabani and a few others, and the Goran split off from the PUK, which has now re-entered a coalition with the PUK. The spark for, now these tensions, of course, have always been there. The PUK and the KDP fought a long civil war not that long ago. So these tensions are always there just below the surface. They have very different ways of looking at the world. But the spark that brought this back is the presidency crisis. To put it in, again, pithy terms that the Goran people like to use, President Barzani is now in the 11th year of his 8-year term. This has brought Kurdish politics to a slow boil and sometimes a high boil. The Goran the party most opposed to the extension of Barzani's presidency, has been thrown out of the government. They used to have the Speaker of the Parliament and several ministries. They've been purged from that. This is what drove them back to the PUK, I believe, and they're now in coalition with them. PUK and Goran have serious problems with the KDP's Baghdad policy. The PUK and Goran are much more conciliatory towards Baghdad, whereas the KDP policy has been more and more hostile. And, of course, this all occurs in the context of the Kurdish region's territorial expansion, which brings about a plethora of political problems, as well as its fiscal crisis. Quite frankly, they're not just broke. They're deeply, deeply underwater, as in tens of billions underwater. So there are high levels of distrust between the Kurdish parties, increasing tribalism, and it does not go too far to say that the return of civil war in the Kurdish region, while by no means likely, is not impossible either. Sunni v. Sunni. Sunni politics, let's be frank, have always been a disaster. I think this was mostly because the idea of a Sunni Arab Iraqi is a identity that had no meaning before 2003. The Kurds have always understood themselves as Kurds. The Shia, because of their persecuted status and the centrality of their leaders in Najaf, also understood themselves, at least in some sense, as a unitary entity, despite their own internal tensions. But I suspect never before have the Moslawis, the Ambaris, the Sunni residents of Baghdad, Diyala, and Saladin seen themselves as a unified entity. In some ways, this is an identity that has been imposed on them, in no small part by the United States, by al-Qaeda, and to some extent by the Gulf states. So the Sunnis have always been in a bad place, but unfortunately it's gotten worse. They are now fighting over vastly diminished resources. Their cities have been leveled. Their industries and farms have been razed. Their infrastructure is at best neglected, if not actively destroyed. Their population is dispersed, deprived of education, health care, and so on. In short, all the normal things that you use to build political power, you know, people being in society, economic resources, things functioning, these have all been taken away from Iraq Sunni populations. So while we talk about empowering Iraq Sunni, in fact, the normal political nature of things will actually be for their power to diminish, simply because they do not have the resources from which political power is inherently generated. This is further complicated by the fact that, let's be honest, all of the Kurdish gains in territorial acquisition have almost without exception come from Sunni populations. This is, in essence, a zero-sum game for these two populations. You cannot simultaneously be a fan of Kurdish expansion and simultaneously want the Sunni to retain the level of political power that they've had in the past. These are at least in deep tension, if not just out-and-out contradictory. So the post-ISIL intra-Sunni dynamics will be key. This is a civil war that divides the Sunni people perhaps more deeply than did the United States' civil war. The best example given to me by a friend of mine that I like to use is the Anbar operations commander, General Ismail al-Malawi, is the first cousin to the senior ISIL commander killed in Anbar so far, Muhammad al-Malawi. So senior general on each side, first cousins. And it is not uncommon in the police to see brothers that are on fairly major figures in each side that are, you know, full brothers or half brothers. This is a conflict that has deeply divided the Sunni population. And so when some people say, well, you're concerned about what will happen with Shia retribution against the Sunnis, well, the Shia haven't lived under ISIL. They're really not that all upset. It's the Sunni retribution against other Sunnis that we need to be deeply concerned about. These Sunnis have lived under ISIL occupation. They know exactly who are and were the collaborators, and that's going to be a very difficult problem to deal with in the not-too-distant future. For the Shia, I would say we could call this technocracy versus Shia supremacy. Those who want government, you know, competent, legitimate government that delivers services versus those who see Shia supremacy. We could say that this would be Western-looking versus Iranian-looking, but that actually oversimplifies and it doesn't map exactly. This two-part dichotomy is then further complicated by the Sadrists, who do tap into Shia populist sentiment but are deeply anti-Iranian. So while the Sadrist demonstrators and building seizures in the green zone that we saw in the past weeks and months weren't particularly helpful for the government, once they got there, they were mostly chanting anti-Iranian slogans. So this is a group that cuts both ways and can't be neatly put into either camp. The pro-Iranian camp, the Shia supremacist camp, is obviously led by former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, and then other figures we remember, Mohandas Karzai, and kind of, sort of, Hadi al-Amri of the Bonner Corps, although they're also in an interesting, not quite in, not quite out middle ground. It would be simpler if we could just talk about the PMF or the PMUs or the Hashid or the Shia militias, whichever term you want to use, and say, well, they're in this camp or they're in this camp, but unfortunately, they run the gamut. There are members of the PMF, the Hashid, that are deeply aligned with the reform movements that come out of Najaf, that are very loyal to Sistani, to Najaf, and Karbala, and are clearly in cahoots with the government, take direct orders from the government, and are extremely well-behaved. On the other side, we, of course, have Iraqi Hezbollah, a designated terrorist group about which we have very few good things to say. And then again, it runs the spectrum in between with Sadr's Peace Brigades and the Badr Corps, again, in a neutral ground that I think even those of us who study this closely are a little confused about exactly what are their intentions and just how much can we trust them and are they on the side of the angels or not. Very briefly, let me talk then, because I'm almost out of time, about what I see as the reform forces that are moving forward in Iraq. We're in a very interesting position where we have at least five major groups calling for significant reform in Iraq. You have Prime Minister Abadi, who talks about it almost ceaselessly. You have Muqtada al-Sadr, who bangs the drum continually on the need for reform in the government, anti-corruption. You have the Arab Street, which, again, is partially giving support to Sadr, but that is way too simple to say they are all in the Sadrist camp. There's deep discontent with what's going on in Baghdad. Najaf, the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, has made it very clear he is not happy with the way the government is working, with the level of corruption, with the dysfunction. He wants change. And, of course, the IMF, the World Community, the World Bank, these institutions are also trying to push reform on Baghdad. Now, of course, I don't think any of those five groups mean the same thing when they talk about reform, but at least they're moving in a generally good direction. We have a similar thing going on in Kurdistan with the Garan Party. They're incompetent. They really don't know what they're doing. They flail, but their intentions are good. Even if they can't quite put it all together, and they do serve as a consistent voice against corruption in the KRG, even if they aren't in a position, either by numbers or competency, to do much about it. There does appear to be some judicial independence coming about. We've seen them overturn decisions of the government with some fairly regular frequency in the past months, things that were clearly anti-constitutional that Abadi did. We've seen them happen. So, there is a political dialogue. Of course, now, whether this political dialogue can go anywhere against the very deeply rooted vested interests in the Baghdad government is something else altogether. We will see if the Karada bombing, which just for a sense of scale is the third largest casualty-causing incident in Iraq since the end of the 2003 war, since the end of the invasion, third only to the killing of the 1,700 cadets outside Spiker and the trampling on the Adamiya-Qadamiya Bridge in 2005. This is the third largest casualty-producing event in Iraq since the end of the invasion, and it has catalyzed a lot of movement. But we can certainly see these two sides brought to light in the reaction to what happened in Karada. On one side, on the Shia supremacist, we have these calls for an investigation into what Gulf states provided. This, you know, there must be some radioactivity or something that happened to cause this level of casualties, a deep suspicion, a deep paranoia. That's not particularly helpful. On the other side, you are hearing lots of calls for, you know, let's get rid of the wands. Where's the real bomb detecting equipment? Why on earth don't we have a fire code? Most of these people didn't die in the bombing. They died in the fire that ensued from the bombing in a building that had no fire exits. These are calls by the Iraqi people for legitimate government that actually provides services, and this does provide us some ray of hope as we move forward.
Thank you, Douglas. Thank you for providing sort of a rich, both the negatives and the deep challenges, as well as some glimmers of hope and some realism that positive things might be happening as well. Charles, let's turn to you. Impact on ISIS, Al-Qaeda. Jessica mentioned a few elements related to that, but your thoughts, please.
Thanks, Paul. Good afternoon. I'm going to try and present a bit of a big picture overlook at where ISIS is today in terms of reflecting on the loss of Fallujah, what that might mean for the militant movement going forward. And I'm also going to cross between Syria and Iraq. I'm a strong believer, as I hope probably most are, that Syria and Iraq, as a single campaign, must be acknowledged. The two countries, in terms of fighting ISIS and other jihadist organizations, should not be seen as individually distinct. But first of all, just to speak from a really big picture, we've come a long way since the capture of Mosul in June 2014. I think we spent a long time as a growing international coalition reacting to events on the ground. I don't think until probably at least the late summer of last year did the counter-ISIL campaign begin to really reflect something that made sense both in the immediate term and also in some sense in terms of looking long-term. So I do think we are very much seeing the consequences of a much more well-developed strategy being played out now. And that strategy is, as far as I'm concerned, a very heavy military-focused effort. By targeting ISIL's control of territory, by targeting its senior leadership, its command and control infrastructure, its sources of finance, and its access to borders. I think since at least the winter of last year, perhaps from September, October onwards, we've seen, at that point, I think we saw the coalition turning a very big corner against ISIL, and ever since, I think we've started to see the real positive consequences of those actions. The ISIL's loss of Fallujah is, of course, the most recent and the most high-profile victory that we have secured against the organization, and I share Jessica's assessment that it was surprisingly quick. Part of me wants to say we shouldn't celebrate so fast because it was quick. I think if there's one thing we have learned about ISIL elsewhere, both operating in Syria and Iraq over the last several years, it has been known to carry out strategic withdrawals for the purpose of fighting another day elsewhere, just as much as it has been known for operating like it did in Kobani, where they just simply threw in hundreds of fighters as cannon fodder into a battle they were never going to win. So I do think we should be raising some question mark. We are certainly winning the battle against ISIL, but I think we have still a very long way to go. ISIL is undoubtedly weaker now than it has been since the capture of Mosul, and indeed since probably 2008, 2009. But it's an organization, again, as I think Jessica said, as an organization that is more than capable of adapting to new situations. My personal assessment is we're seeing ISIL in some areas of Iraq in particular readapting and adapting itself to operating in the way that it did really post-2008, 2009. Through the loss of significant strategic territory, it retreats back into urban areas and infiltrates rather than controls territory. I think the increase in suicide bombings carried out by ISIL in places like Baghdad is an easy reflection of that. This is exactly the same kind of way ISIL was operating in 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, all the way up to the big offensive we saw in 2014. It's just simply another way of ISIL to demonstrate a capacity to have an influence within certain core strategic areas where its effect can have the most significant consequences on its adversaries. And of course, that most importantly means chaos, instability, and destabilization. So that's the big picture look in terms of where things have moved since over the last 2 years. Next, I mean, how is ISIS going to react? As I say, clearly they are losing. They are weaker than they have been for a long time. The most high-profile, the most obvious way that we are seeing ISIL react already is what I would call the lashback effect. That is through, in that I mean, their, both their inspiration and directing of spectacular attacks, both in their immediate vicinity in the broader region and further afield in the Western world. Some of these attacks go claimed, many of them are claimed, but some have also gone unclaimed. And I think there's significant and important questions to ask about why that is as well, and perhaps we can bring that up in the Q&A session afterwards. But this lashback effect carries out very much or brings forward the same consequences that big spectacular bombings in places like Baghdad bring. It allows ISIS to present a sort of secondary source of momentum, which we all know very clearly is critically important for the organization. And it also allows a sense in Europe, or a sense of complete instability, a sense of terror, and this is exactly what ISIS wants to be creating in the Western world. Of course, it's hoping that we will then carry out our own lashback effect, both domestically in places like France, for example. ISIS no doubt hopes that European countries will start to crack down on Muslim communities and bring about the exact kind of conditions they want there. So number one, the lashback effect. Number two, I do believe ISIS is starting to retreat back into its core territories. In that, I do mean the big urban areas like Mosul, Raqqa, also core Sunni Arab, long-time influential areas like Anbar and Deir ez-Zor in western and eastern Iraq and Syria, respectively. In a sense, I think we're seeing a phase of ISIL preparing to defend its two de facto capitals in Iraq and Syria, whilst trying to disrupt as best it can the campaign, the coalition acting against it elsewhere. Number three, it will continue to seek to destabilize and disrupt and divert broader dynamics in Syria and Iraq. And I think if anything, is probably the most critical and the most obvious thing we'll start to see play out, or in fact, I think we already have. I've already talked about the big bombings in Baghdad, including in Qarada. We've also seen similar big bombings in Balad and Samarra targeting Shia targets. I think, again, this is a very well-practiced ISIS strategy. You target the Shia in the hope that the Shia will then come back and do something against the Sunni community. This is, unfortunately, a practice that ISIS has successfully carried out in the past in Iraq, and it will certainly try to do so again, especially considering divisions within the PMUs, the idea or the impression that the Iran-backed militias are resistant to following through with orders. I think we've seen a relatively clear demonstration of some of the more troublesome PMU actors in Fallujah, the hanging up of posters with pretty vicious sectarian slogans. Just a poster can have a damaging effect in that respect, in terms of the stabilization effect in places like Fallujah. ISIS will also seek, I think, to further destabilize dynamics between the Kurdish community and the Sunni Arab community in northern Syria. This is something that many Syria analysts have been concerned about for a long time in terms of the shape of our counter-ISIL coalition and the quite dramatic emboldening of certain Kurdish militia groups in northern Syria. And this is something that the broader Sunni Arab community is not happy about. There are some exceptions to that rule, but I am concerned in terms of the long-term ability for ISIS to exploit those difficulties. Lebanon is another interesting one. I've been speaking quite a lot to almost all of the armed opposition groups across Syria on a very regular basis. But one thing I picked up from three separate groups based in northern Aleppo a couple of weeks ago was that upwards of 200 to 300 Lebanese ISIL fighters were allowed through a deal safe passageway through the opposition-controlled and then regime-controlled territories in northern Aleppo, safe passageway back to Lebanon. That we then saw the eight or nine suicide bombers emerge in a town on the Lebanese border with Syria very shortly thereafter, and I have no doubt that some of those militants that crossed from Syria into Lebanon were involved in that incident. So I feel like Lebanon may be, unfortunately, expecting another period of potential instability, and ISIS as ISIS will seek to use Lebanon as a staging ground or a demonstration of their strategic depth. And then finally, broader Syrian issues of complexity that ISIS will try to exploit in terms of dividing the opposition. I don't really have time today to talk in depth about the proposed US-Russia deal, but I think the extremely damaging consequences that will have in terms of pushing a jihadist narrative on the ground is something that not only al-Qaeda will be able to gain hugely from, but I think it's also an opportunity for ISIL that we ought to be aware of, including potentially the possibility that some elements within ISIL, particularly Syrian elements, may seek to create some kind of new detente with al-Qaeda in Syria. If there's one thing that we've learned, that if there's one point of, how do I put it? ISIL and al-Qaeda, there is so much bad blood between these organizations in Syria that it really can't be underestimated, the extent of bad blood between them. But if there's one thing that can potentially bring them either back together, which I don't see happening, or at least see them agree to not fight each other in any situation, it is mass external intervention. We saw it after the U.S. intervened in 2014, where a number of al-Qaeda figures announced that they would stop fighting ISIL as an expression of Islamic solidarity. A major U.S.-Russian effort against Nusra and ISIS, as this proposal stands, could have the potentiality to have even more of an effect in that respect, and I think that's something we should also be aware of. One of the final points I make, which I made at the very beginning, we must see the campaigns in Syria and Iraq as inextricably linked. The current effort against ISIL in the town of Manbij in northern Syria has made some significant strides over the last 24 hours, I think after actually taking longer than we expected. Once ISIL does lose Manbij, and this will happen, Manbij represents the last main border town on the Syria-Turkey border that ISIL is currently in control of. Once Manbij is lost, the border with Iraq will become of existential value to ISIS. Towns like Al-Qaim and Al-Bukamal on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border will become of real, real critical importance. And I think that, more than perhaps anything, underlines how important it must be to see these two countries and the two campaigns in both countries as inextricably linked. The same thing as Jessica said as well, the idea that al-Qaeda may be looking to expand into Iraq one day in the future if ISIL really does experience a kind of catastrophic defeat in terms of control of territory. I think that is certainly possible. Several very senior al-Qaeda figures released from Iran roughly a year ago, went immediately to Iraq to establish or re-establish connections with people who basically refused to join ISIS when it entered Syria in 2013. So clearly there is some extent of infrastructure there already existing for al-Qaeda to make an effort like that. But it certainly would be unwise for it to try that now. But 12 months from now, who knows? The final point I will make is we have the momentum in the battle against ISIS now. That much is clear. But I would hold fast and say we shouldn't rush. I think there's a sense here in Washington that Obama has several months left as president. I think there is a renewed urgency now to get Mosul going before he leaves. Several victories around Mosul have had a very significant effect, I think, in pushing that forward, most notably the capture of the Qiyara base. But if, again, there's one thing that we should have learned over the last 10 years about fighting in places like Iraq, it's that when we push these things too fast and we don't set up the stabilization, when we don't set up legitimate and representative actors to hold and govern territory afterwards, we're simply delaying another comeback for ISIL or another organization like it. So I would place significant emphasis on preparing the ground for the day after, rather than rushing some of these operations, even though we seem to have the momentum to do so right now. And one simple example of that was, we've been developing, or the US government has been developing, a small counter-ISIL force in southern Syria known as the New Syrian Army. It has about 150 fighters, really, really quite small. Man for man, though, it's been receiving probably the most qualitative and quantitative military assistance of any counter-ISIL force, including the Kurds in northern Syria, including any other non-government actors in Iraq. bizarrely, we pushed them into attacking one of ISIL's best defended towns in all of Syria and Iraq. Not even the whole 150-man force was sent. Quite a bizarre strategic move. Unsurprisingly, they were very quickly defeated. Several of their fighters were beheaded on video. A significant quantity of American military equipment was seized, including some that was still packaged in cardboard boxes from New Haven, Connecticut. This, I think, is as an easy example of the need to not rush. We have the momentum, but we need to use that smartly and not give ISIL an opportunity, whether it be in terms of information, operations, psychological operations, or simply military victories.
Thank you very much, Charles. Let's turn to Robert, your views.
Thank you, Paul. It's a delight to be on this panel with very distinguished people, and it's a delight to be back at SAIS. I'm an alumni from 1983. I did Middle East studies here. I met my wife here. As an alumni, I would like to just ask, we have a pretty big audience today, how many of you were SAIS students doing Middle East? Okay, those four or five of you, if what you've heard already doesn't convince you, let me tell you, turn back now. Ask the dean to study Europe. Well, no, not Europe. Maybe East Asia. Let me just talk a little about, I wanted to talk about the long term. I really take to heart what Doug said about looking at Iraq today and politics in Iraq today in 2016 with the lenses from 2006, people like me, is not going to give you an accurate picture. And so what I say here about Iraq, I caution that it's from someone who was there for a long time, but also a long time ago. What concerns me is that in 2016, we still have 5,000 American forces in Iraq. And frankly, a lot of us who were in Iraq in, say, 2008, 9, 10, we thought our forces would be long gone by now, and we're still there. And so my question today is, how does this end? And what can we be thinking about? I'm not saying we have the answers. What can we be thinking about in such a way that Iraq and someday, I hope, Syria, have security and have stability again? And so that's the question I pose. So let me go through some thoughts. Keep in mind, the long-term question for me is, how do you undercut extremist recruiting? How do you undercut extremist recruiting? There are three sort of topics that I want to throw out that I think each contribute, although none is by itself the answer, and even all three together are not the answer. But there are definitely important elements. So I'm going to talk about refugees. I'm going to talk about reconstruction. And I'm going to talk about ruling, and especially local ruling, local governance. So on refugees, and I focus on Iraq, but a lot of what I'm saying is also applicable to Syria. I think what Charles said about you can't really separate these two conflicts, I totally, totally agree with that. I actually think of it as one war with an Eastern Front and a Western Front. I'm going to talk mostly about the Eastern Front, but a lot of this applies to the Western Front. So refugees. First, just give you a sense of the scale of the problem. When I was in Iraq a long time ago, there were 1.5 million refugees, almost 2 million at one point. Now, 3.5 million, according to the United Nations and the IOM. Out of that roughly 3.5 million, and by the way, this is 3.5 million since January 2014. Out of that 3.5 million, 87%, according to the IOM, are from Anbar, Nineveh, and Salah ad-Din. 87%. So that's over 3 million people. That's a lot of displaced, mostly Sunnis. That's a lot. Now, some are returning, and people in the Obama administration highlight that a lot of the refugees have returned to Tikrit. I noticed that the Qaim Maqam, the, if you will, the mayor of Ramadi, has claimed that 60% of the refugees from Ramadi have not gone home. That was in a press statement he gave to El Medda Press in Iraq earlier this week. He said 250,000. Personally, I find that number very hard to believe. But I can believe that some have gone back. I can't believe there are homes for 250,000 people in Ramadi, given the destruction there. And there even is a trickle of some refugees coming back into Fallujah now, according to the Anbar Governorate Council, Anbar being the province of western Iraq. The Anbar Council said some of the refugees are coming back into Fallujah, and in particular Fallujah Amariya. But there are problems getting the refugees back. I want to talk about just some of the immediate problems and then some of the longer problems. Getting refugees processed so that they can go home again is taking longer than expected. The same Anbar Council member who was talking about refugees returning to Fallujah said there are over 15,000 people in camps in Amariya waiting for screeners, security service screeners. This is just a bureaucracy manpower problem. I don't think it signifies ill intent from Baghdad. I just think it's a personnel problem. Having worked in the U.S. State Department, I have some sympathy with that. I don't know why you're laughing. Second, and this goes to a point Doug mentioned about the screening of people. The head of the force, the Sunni force, Doug mentioned, and also members of the Sunni Hashid, the Sunni militias that are out there, have said they're not going to let any of the people who were sympathizers, who gave aid to the Islamic State, they're not going to let them back, and that they know their names. They may well know many of the names, but there's two problems here. Number one, I have never seen any human endeavor, not in Washington, not in Washington governance, and certainly not in Iraq, that is not error-prone. There are a lot of divisions among Sunnis. Doug mentioned a few. I'm going to talk about more later. The potential for abuse in this screening process is very high. And so you have to ask the question of what is the process, how transparent is it, and what is the appeals process? If you don't have an appeals process, you don't have transparency, you don't have buy-in, you are setting a problem up for the future. Refugees who don't get to go home again, don't get to go back to Ramadi, don't get to go back to Fallujah, don't get to go back one day to Mosul, where are they going to go? And what kind of help are they going to get? Keep in mind my underlying question, undercut extremist recruitment long term. So let me talk about rebuilding, because refugees will go home. That's a great thing. That's a great thing. We need them to go home. But what are they going to go home to? The mayor of Ramadi again, the Qaim Maqam, in another press interview with Iraqi Press, this one from last month, said that 80% of the city is damaged or destroyed. And the United Nations has done satellite surveys of Ramadi that say 60% of the housing was destroyed. The Islamic State, as they were withdrawing, made a special effort to blow up homes. I mean, it's an incredibly nasty, apocalyptic way to retreat from the city. Just to give you an example, this same mayor of Ramadi said that there are 22 bridges in the city, you know, city straddles the Tigris River. 22 of the bridges there, only one is functional. Can you imagine living in a city with a river in the middle of it and there are no bridges? I mean, think about that for a minute. And he said they're having trouble repairing even the bridges because there's no money. Up in Tikrit, which the administration has highlighted as a success of the post-Islamic State period, electricity, not surprising, those of us from 10 years ago in Iraq would say, what a surprise, electricity is short. And there are shortages now. But I want you to think about this. As refugees come back into Tikrit, do you think they add to the consumption of electricity? Do you think they add to the demand? I studied economics here at SAIS. It looks to me like we're going to have a supply and demand mismatch. There will not be equilibrium, let's put it that way. And so reconstruction of electricity infrastructure, not just for Tikrit, but for all of these areas, will be hugely important. Infrastructure, housing. Who's going to do that? Well, the Baghdad budget, is now under an IMF structural adjustment program. I have not yet read, I've not seen on the internet, the IMF staff report, the Article 4, but it'll come out and it'll be highly worth reading. But I have worked on structural adjustment programs in Algeria and in Cameroon and in Egypt. And I have yet to see an IMF structural adjustment program that doesn't require some cuts in infrastructure spending as well as hiring. And I would assume that that's what's going to be in this IMF program. And the Reuters report announcing this structural adjustment program at the IMF specifically said the budget is to be cut public expenditures by 15% to balance, to get them back to budget equilibrium, and that hiring is to be frozen. So I want you to think about this. The refugees are coming back. Homes are destroyed. Infrastructure is out. Where are they going to find jobs? Don't imagine there are a lot of public companies coming into Ramadi or Fallujah. Won't be a lot going into Mosul. Where's it going to come from? Now, the IMF is providing some help. I mean, sorry, the World Bank is providing a $350 million loan for reconstruction. It's good. The UN is trying to organize as well. They've got an $800 million urgent requirements budget, but it's only been funded to 35-36% so far. And so here's a date to think about. July 20th, there's going to be a conference co-sponsored by Washington, Canada, and Germany, July 20th, to generate international community resources to help the Iraqis rebuild. That kind of effort, given the budget problems in Iraq, that kind of effort will be hugely important. They will be really dependent on international support, oddly enough, given that they are such a rich oil country. Why does all of this matter for extremist recruitment? I don't know if you've seen them. I highly recommend them. There are two polls that have come out in the last 3 months, public opinion surveys among Arab youth. One is the Burston Marsteller report from April 2016. You can get them, Google them. And then the second was a survey of Syrian youth undertaken both in Syria and outside of Syria, 800 interviewees. Both polls showed that the number one reason young people join extremist groups is lack of jobs and lack of income. And so think about those refugees coming back. They don't have jobs, they don't have income, no prospects. Even if it's only 1 or 2 or 3% of 3 million, that's a lot. That's over 100,000 right there. So, last point, ruling, governance. And I'm not talking about Baghdad. I'm really talking about the towns, the cities that are recaptured. Fallujah has been recaptured. Ramadi has been recaptured. These are good things. Mosul will be recaptured, I'm very sure. And someday, I hope, I'm sure, Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor will be recaptured in Syria. But then what? In Iraq, Jessica mentioned the problem with the Shia militias. Charles touched on it. I noticed that Ned Parker, who is the longtime reporter, he's been in Iraq longer than I was, and is just now back about a year, he said his contacts in Tikrit are telling him the Shia militia are still running things. They're not in front, they're in back. But people understand that they are the actual authority. The Baiji refinery, Ned mentioned, which is a key infrastructure node in Iraq, has not been rebuilt, and it's still under the control, not of the central government, but under control of the Hashd. I wonder if that isn't a harbinger of things to come. In Anbar, I'm not sure if the Shia militias, the Hashd, the Iranian-supported militias are going to be a problem or not. I don't know. Charles mentioned about the posters in Fallujah. Absolutely a problem, but maybe they're going to withdraw and be part of the holding forces that Jessica mentioned. I don't know. In any case, in Anbar, there's Sunni-Sunni conflict. This is a division between Islamists in Anbar. The Muslim Brotherhood Party is there. It's called the Iraqi Islamic Party. And they're arguing, they're fighting politically with tribal sheikh alliances. The governor of Ramadi, you've seen him on television, those of you who follow Iraq closely, his name is Rawi. He's just been fired because he was an Islamist party supporter. The sheikhs mustered a majority in the local council and fired him. The Islamist party in return has now launched a corruption investigation against the head of the local council who is allied to the sheikhs. This is just rough politics, Iraqi style. Nobody's been killed, so it's not that rough. But this is the way the Iraqis play politics. The important thing for this audience to understand, I wish Washington would understand this, not all Sunni Arabs agree on things. They're very fragmented. Doug was talking about it at a national level, but it's also true at a local level. There are splits, there's fragmentation among the Sunni Arab communities in places like Mosul and in places like Anbar. There are splits and rivalries between tribes that go back before the American invasion even. Some of them predate Saddam Hussein. There are fights between secularists and Islamists, young people versus old people, leaders versus up-and-coming leaders. This kind of fragmentation makes it really hard to build governance structures. If I could give you one good thing to read to understand this fragmentation of Sunni Arabs in Iraq, read the Anand Gopal article in the Atlantic magazine from May 2016. It's called The Hell After ISIS. And he goes into, in great detail, it's a very readable article, it's excellent, on how in the town of Hate, on the Iraq side of the border, the Sunni Arabs were so split amongst themselves after the American success of the surge and the Sahwa, the awakening, and how the rise of ISIS can actually be traced back to splits within the Sunni Arab community that go all the way back to the success, relative for the Americans, of 2008 and 2009. So it's not a simple answer, who's going to govern. And to just say Sunni Arabs are going to govern, it's not an answer, because we already did that once. That's what 2008 and 2009 were. Different question. Who's going to choose them, and who's going to accept them? The rulers, I mean. What kind of process is there going to be? And what kind of processes will there be to set up the rule of law, including the local security forces? And this will be a huge, huge question in Syria as well. So with that, Paul, leaving just those questions open, because I didn't say I had the answers, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Let me take a few minutes to ask sort of a question each of our panelists, and then turn it over to you for your questions to our panelists. Let me start with Jessica. If you could give us your views a bit about the Iraqi army, I mean the regular army that sort of half collapsed in 2014, couldn't fight the ISIS advance, and yet now some of its units, the anti-terrorism, some of the special forces, some of the regular units, are engaged. We're very aware of the PMU, the variety of those, and some of their transgressions. But if we wanted to look at the glass half full and what can be built on, and keeping in mind, you know, the new U.S. administration, is there something there to build on? Is there a trajectory to lean on in Iraq and the Iraqi armed forces? What would you say about that?
Certainly. I think the overarching question is, yes, there is something to build on. There are units like the CTS, the counterterrorism services, with whom we not only recognize that they have capacity offensively, but that we also have a good relationship with them. So there is a basis to not only train and advise, but to relate as a coalition in a way that I think is very positive. The challenges largely stem from the available forces compared to the entire footprint of Iraq, in my view. The front lines are extensive, and we really must regard the front line as not only those places that haven't been liberated yet, but all the places that have been liberated, period, that extend from Salah ad-Din to Anbar to Nineveh to Kirkuk to Diyala. They're all a front line. And I think the defensive positions to which Doug alluded around the holy cities and Najaf in particular are also part of that front line because they're not that far away from Anbar, actually. They abut the desert as well. So the forces that are capable have to be split over a wide swath of terrain that really does include most of middle and northern and western Iraq. Interestingly, we should also regard the disposition of forces that must also apply to southern Iraq, where there have, over the course of the last year, also been a number of protest movements. So security of communities is a broad mission that doesn't just apply to the war against ISIS. Who is going to control Basra is a very politically relevant question. And if the answer turns out to be that the forces we know and have trained and work well with, who are tactically capable, are the ones who are going to keep fighting the next battle against ISIS, and the forces who are going to hold the cities are going to be some combination of the less capable Iraqi army divisions, the federal police, who are within the Ministry of Interior, which again crosses into the question of what are the political goals and objectives of some of the militias that have Iranian ties, then we're also really needing to scale back and ask the question of who's going to end up with the mission that used to belong to the federal police throughout the rest of Iraq. So I am concerned that while there are lots of positive aspects and elements to build upon within the Iraqi army, there are divisions we have literally built back from scratch that are not capable of going back to Mosul yet, but the trajectory is positive. The requirement is much bigger than the available force. Mm. That the overall situation does favor elements that are outside of the government structure. So I think the goal could be to legitimize forces that are willing to answer to a multi-ethnic force structure that is embedded within the government of Iraq and responsive to it. But I think we're a long way off from that goal. We have a lot of guns in the battlefield and a lot of different agendas and leaders, and that we do need to scale the requirement against the full breadth of security in Iraq, not just against the next battle.
Thank you.
ISIS.
Thank you, Jessica. Douglas, definitely, I mean, all three communities have deep divisions and problems, but perhaps as you yourself indicated, within the Sunni community, it's deeper. First, conceptually, it's deeper. They didn't think of themselves as a community. They're not used to not being in power. The limited power that might be available to them is small and difficult to mobilize people around. In addition, whereas the Kurds and the Shiites have leadership and parties that, you know, they might be fighting a bit amongst themselves, but you can identify them as you have, the Sunnis don't, or those that are there are not valid counterparts to negotiate with Baghdad, whether it's the Ba'ath or ISIS or other. There's a really, really deep crisis. And also among the Sunnis, the potential backers between Turkey, Qatar, Saudi are divided, whereas for the Shia, at least there is one external person. So my question, if you could dig a bit deeper into the Sunni side of that crisis, but look to what could outsiders do? What is a pathway to rebuild some kind of Sunni leadership that could deal with these political challenges with Baghdad and perhaps with Erbil as well? Is there any role for the U.S. in that also?
So I think this is complicated by the existence of the external actors. You know, as both Robert and I have gone into in some detail, you know, this is not a unified community. It's never been a unified community. There are tribal distinctions, there are geographic distinctions, there are ideological distinctions, you know, and then you get into all the personal, you know, intramural fights that go on below those. And yet there are powerful external actors who want to see this fight through a Sunni-Shia lens and really keep us from seeing that yes, you know, certainly Iranian influence is a problem. I think we're at the point we have to acknowledge it's not the problem. It's a problem, don't get me wrong, but it is not the problem. The problem will be, I believe, putting together some type of unified Sunni body that can speak for their community. And this has been a problem for a long time, as Robert knows better than I. I've been saying this for a while. I mean, we can all concede that Nouri al-Maliki was no Nelson Mandela, and he did not reach out across to the Sunni to try to, you know, really get a long-term deal that visualized how these communities work together. But where was his F.W. de Klerk? Who was a figure who could speak for the Sunni and come to Baghdad and say, okay, yes, you know, we have to permanently renounce the Ba'ath, you know, the Sunni are never going to run this country again. It's never going to be as good for Anbar and as it was under the old regime. We're not going to have a disproportionate amount of services anymore. We have to renounce violence. Now we want our rights as a minority community inside Iraq. There's no one to make that case. There's no interlocutor for a very clearly unified Shia community in Baghdad to speak to. And I think that's the problem as we move forward. Yeah, I think that's going to be obviously the same problem in Syria. You know, what unifies the Sunni who are in ISIL with the Sunni who are in the moderate opposition with the Sunni who are still in the Syrian army and the government-aligned militias? You know, what holds this community together, and in what sense can we talk about this as, you know, Sunni Arabs? And I think that's something I've really come to over the last year, is this idea that there is a Sunni Arab community is something that has been imposed on them, and they've only come to see themselves because we're making them see themselves that way, but that's not a natural identity, I don't believe.
Thank you, Douglas. Charles, I want to ask you a question about the narrative, ISIS narrative and al-Qaeda narrative. ISIS, the ISIS brand was built on their success first of all, having large, you know, military successes as a sign of God's favor, mm-hmm. and then establishing territory and announcing a caliphate. My question is, if they're being rolled back, and particularly if they lose more of the big central cities, as you indicated, what does that mean for their brand and for their narrative? Yes, they can do car bombs and they can infiltrate. And as you follow sort of debates within the jihadi community, how are even these defeats being interpreted within the sort of the theology? So do you see a future, as sort of Jessica indicated and sometimes you indicate as well, that, yeah, ISIS might be defeated on the ground, might even be deflated as a brand, then al-Qaeda will come up, to take advantage? Or is the ISIS brand itself more malleable and can survive with some new narrative other than having an actual caliphate?
Difficult question. ISIS, all the way since 2006, has presented itself as a state, right? So I think in terms of its potential supporters, potential recruits, and existing members, the difference to them, practically speaking, between a state and a caliphate is fairly negligible. So long as, and of course, the Islamic State in Iraq existed for years whilst it didn't overtly control territory after the surge. And it survived and came back to be what it was in 2014. So I don't think what we're seeing right now is the defeat of the idea that ISIS can present itself as a state to its potential supporters. I don't, unfortunately, don't think that will ever necessarily go away. With that being said, I think probably the more important dynamic for ISIS is the momentum idea. And that's something that they have driven for a very long time in terms of their presentation from a state to a caliphate. And I think the response to that loss has been seen very clearly. I mean, yes, as I mentioned, the anti-ISIS operations have successfully taken back almost all of ISIL's access to the Syria-Turkey border where it was acquiring its foreign fighters from. But nevertheless, at the same time, all governments in the West and in the region monitoring foreign fighter flows towards Syria and Iraq have made very clear that they've dramatically declined. Yes, some of that is due to the difficulty of getting in-country, but I suspect a lot of it is also due to the less attractive nature of joining an organization that's currently going through hard times. I mentioned in my presentation that ISIS has demonstrated an ability to adapt very swiftly in the past, and again, it's adapting its narrative as we speak. I mean, its chief spokesman, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, released a long statement a few weeks ago in which he basically was admitting that, yes, we're losing territory, yes, we are having to fall back, but our cause, nevertheless, is as strong as it always has been. This is just a reflection of the world turning against Islam, blah, blah, blah. This is all the more reason why we need more recruits, why we need to continue to inspire and carry out attacks around the world. So there's always going to be an ability for an organization like ISIS to adapt its narrative according to the circumstances that it finds itself in. And of course, it's become an international organization since 2014. And there will always be a potential for the organization to seek out a place like Libya or Afghanistan or the Philippines or wherever as a secondary source of potential. I don't think any of those places will ever see the kind of scale of ISIS activity that we've seen develop in Syria and Iraq. But it certainly can provide a sense of alternative momentum mm-hmm. to a support base. And very briefly, in terms of Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda globally, and especially in Syria, is on a very steep upward trajectory in terms of its ability to succeed on the battlefield, in terms of its ability to present itself internationally as a more legitimate and more durable and sustainable into the long term successful jihadist movement. And I think as ISIS does continue to constrain and lose territory, we're going to see that that trend continue even more. And another thing that's been interesting, again, I mentioned northern Aleppo and the crossing of Lebanese ISIL fighters to Lebanon. Well, another thing that's happened more recently as pressure on ISIL fighters in the northeastern Aleppo theater has continued to increase, what we've seen again is defections of Syrian ISIL fighters who have wanted to come back to the opposition, quote unquote, and join organizations like Jabhat al-Nusra. And there's a roughly, as far as I'm told, 65 of those Syrian fighters right now north of Aleppo who are currently being vetted, interviewed, interrogated by US-backed opposition groups with regards to the potentiality that they could rejoin opposition forces and fight against the Assad regime. So there's a potential benefit there to Al-Qaeda in terms of Syrians coming back. But I think foreign fighters between the two organizations is pretty...
Thank you, Charles. A quick question, Robert. Of two parts, and looking at sort of longer-term institutional arrangements, I know you've thought a lot and talked a lot internally about the issue of, you know, whether federalism will be one of the things that's proposed. Others obviously have thought of division long-term, but within the, you know, the constitutional context of Iraq today, how might you see elections, federalism, local governance in Anbar, and so on, in the medium term after sort of dealing with the immediate emergencies, and possibly the issue of the National Guard, which has been on the agenda. How do you see institutional arrangements sort of medium term in Iraq? And the second part, you started your comments by talking about, you know, U.S. expectations when you were there that there would be no troops. And here we are. We're on the verge of a new U.S. administration. Obviously, Iraq is still a bleeding wound or crisis, will require U.S. attention. What kind of U.S. engagement with Iraq do you see or do you recommend? How do you define that engagement with Iraq in the next few years?
On the federalism issue, I think local governance will be key in any case, simply because I don't think Baghdad has the resources to micromanage affairs in the way that the Saddam Hussein government did. But I think the local governance capacities have been severely hit during the Islamic State period, decimated might even not be too strong a word. And so I think that'll be one of the governance challenges, Paul. And if you're going to push for decentralization, you need somebody on the receiving end of authorities to be able to exercise them and to have the capacity to exercise them. And I think that'll be a huge challenge. You know, the United States government made a huge push during the George Bush administration to train local governance people with different, you know, budgets and all kinds of control mechanism. Very difficult, very slow. Building human capacity is not a quick fix. So I think that's going to be a challenge. With respect to what is the American role, we talk about the politics. I'm very happy the administration is sort of focused on this fundraising issue or the resource issue. I just don't see it discussed much in the media here. How many of you knew that there's a conference on July 20 to get money for Iraq? Oh, well, that's more than I would have expected. I mean, that's good. Yeah. But I mean, I haven't seen it in the New York Times, haven't seen it in the Washington Post. So it's not a make or break moment, but it's an important moment because of the budget problems in Baghdad. So it's good the Americans are focused on that, and they better have a plan B if they don't get a big turnout. They don't get a lot of resources. Second thing, I think they need to be asking the Iraqis, both at the Baghdad level and at the local level, what are the processes you're doing to put in place everything from appeals process on screening for refugees to selecting new administrators to instituting elements of rule of law. The Americans don't need to appoint people. I don't even think the Iraqis would accept it even if we wanted to, but we certainly shouldn't be thinking about that. How many times have I been in government where they've said, give us a list of five names that we can take into such and such. Please, let's not do that again. Ask instead, what are the processes that you Iraqis, that you Syrians are putting in place, and talk to them about the processes. Don't ever even mention a name. Don't even say a tribe's name, verboten. And focus on that. I think that would be a much more useful political discussion rather than talking about who in particular governs here and there.
Thank you, Robert.
We always screw that up.
And we are very squeezed for time. My apologies for that. I believe there's microphones roving in the room. I will take a few questions. Let me start with the lady in the fifth row. Stand up so the microphone can come to you, please. Yeah, do stand up. Yes, thank you. Introduce yourself and a quick question. We'll take three or four questions and then responses.
Hi, my name is Shabnam Mojtahedi. I'm with the Syria Justice and Accountability Center. And with the surge in Fallujah, there were atrocities that happened that were mentioned by the panelists, and there were calls internationally for accountability. Prime Minister Abadi said that there would be investigations. What are the prospects for justice and accountability in this situation? Are the courts, are the local courts capable of handling this kind of investigation and prosecution, or does there need to be international involvement in this?
Thank you. Other question, gentlemen in the first row. First row over here. Yes, yes.
Thank you very much. Mike Kurtzig, retired from USDA. Ambassador Ford, I'm interested in your discussion. And in that case, on the economic side, who controls the oil? Where's the oil coming from in the north and the south? And who controls the foreign exchange and the exports? I agree with you 100%. Jobs are a critical problem, not only in Iraq, throughout the Middle East. There are no jobs. That's a problem. Thank you.
I know there are a lot of hands. The gentleman in the third row.
To a certain extent, Sistani has acted as the control rod.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Peter Humphrey. I'm an intel analyst and a former diplomat. To a certain extent, Sistani has acted as a control rod in the nuclear reactor that is Shia Iraq, to the displeasure of us other, of course. And we're looking at a guy, I think, who's 86 years old. So definitely in the next couple of years, we're going to see a real bomb in the highway. And I'm wondering what you view as the unfolding of events following the explosion of that bomb.
Thank you. Gentleman in the very first row here. Right here. There you go.
Thank you very much, Alexander Kravitz from Insight Iraq. I have I was curious about something you mentioned, this the new Syrian army fiasco, the 150 fighters. I'd almost ask the former military members of the panel, who is held accountable for such fiascos? And if so, how? And I mean, it's not the first time it's happened. Let's say a larger question is, the U.S. is providing, aid, financing, I mean, $450 million for the Peshmerga, for example. What kind of conditionality is the United States imposing or not, and might that be missed opportunities? For example, in the case of Peshmerga, for the Kurdish Iraqi Peshmerga, has there been any, there was talk about unification of commands. Might the conditionalities, if any, or the lack thereof, be a missed opportunity?
Thank you. Final question, the young man in the sixth or seventh row. No, the gentleman behind you, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Oh, God. My question is for Charles Lister in particular. So you brought up Medvedev.
Identify yourself, please.
Of course, sorry. I'm Hanny. I'm an intern at the Syria Institute. On Medvedev in particular, that was preceded by the formation of the Medvedev Military Council, and I guess my question is kind of bipartite. On the one hand, to what extent do you think that'll be a sufficient means to the end of providing solid, stable governance in these places that are being soon to be captured? And the second part of the question is, do you see those sort of like institution-building initiatives falling the wayside if the United States embarks on rapid-fire initiatives to capture Mosul and other cities and territory?
Thank you. So we'll turn to the panel. If anybody has other questions, you might accost the panelists as they attempt to escape. But let's go in reverse order. Robert, cherry-pick any of the questions that may have been directed to you. I could remind you of some of them. Issue of just accountability and justice for the atrocities, and who controls the oil?
Doug may want to also talk about the issue of accountability, but I would just say I am not aware of anyone in the Iraqi security establishment, official or unofficial, ever being held accountable for a major human rights abuse like that. It would be a first. So, but there's always a first time, so I hope there is. But it's, to my knowledge, there has never been such. And there certainly wasn't during the Civil War, unfortunately. So we have, I think, Foreign Minister Joffrey visiting Washington this week. He was prime minister during the Jadriya bunker incident when we brought it into him, and I don't think anyone was ever held accountable. So the gentleman asked me about control of petroleum resources. Of course, it's divided between Kurds and the central government, the Ministry of Oil for the Kurdish oil. The deal comes, the deal goes. You know, it's on again, off again, the revenue sharing issue. I think right now it's off again. But it might switch back on. Doug mentioned the serious financial problems that the Kurdish regional government is in, and so this is a huge question. Doug, I know Adel Abdelmehdi has left the oil ministry. Do you know who the new oil minister is? I mean, this is such a sensitive issue in Iraq.
Yeah, I do, but
the identity of the oil minister and whether or not he can work with the Kurdish regional government to me is a huge indicator of stability at the national level. You also asked about foreign exchange. Central bank governor is there with the finance minister, but it all ultimately goes to the prime minister. It's all reported. I mean, he's the. I don't know if Doug has any comments on that.
Thank you, Robert Charles.
I'll quickly fire off on the last two questions. In terms of the new Syrian army operation and accountability, I don't think there's going to be any. Very shortly after the operation went bad, ISIL posted photographs. They've made very clear that they were perceiving this as a great big victory and a humiliation for the U.S. But then probably the day after, U.S. media were quoting a variety of unnamed government sources saying that actually it was quite successful. We did blow up a few buildings. We gathered intelligence and we made contact with tribes. And so there was certainly an effort to belittle this as not so bad as it was, as it seemed. And there was a lot of attention given to the fact that the operation may have failed, because the air cover that was meant to be there was diverted to take pot shots at this ISIL convoy outside Fallujah. And there have been a variety of stories coming from within this armed group as to whether or not they supported the diversion of assets or not. Some of their officials have said we agreed to allow the jets to go back to Iraq. Others have said that they were quite amazed to suddenly see the jets fly off and abandon their fighters on the ground. So there's something, you know, it's the kind of normal story we see, a mixing up of whether there is any accountability or not and who's responsible. On the Manbij question, this is a big concern of mine, and it actually points to something Robert said about our insistence to appoint people all the time. So Manbij was controlled by the opposition for several years before ISIS took over. It had a democratically elected civil council, civilian, no armed groups, nothing. That council was forced into exile about 40 kilometers down the road in Azaz, I believe, as soon as ISIL took over. That council is continuing to release statements saying, we expect to come back to Manbij and reassume our position as the elected council of Manbij. But what have we done? We have elected a externally based Manbij military council to reassume authority over the town. It's not going to work, right? Like, it'll look good for a few weeks. We've captured the town. This smart-looking US-backed Manbij military council will take over. But the people are going to very quickly say, well, hang on a minute. You know, we elected other people to be leading us. These are the people that we see as being representative. So that's something that surefire ISIS will try to exploit. And then that plays in again to your second question. And it's exactly why I say we shouldn't be rushing it. We shouldn't be appointing people, and we shouldn't be over-rushing some of these operations for precisely this reason. We're making tactical gains. I say this every time I speak publicly. We're making tactical gains against ISIL, and that's fantastic. But are they strategic? Are they going to be durable and sustainable 3 years from now? And some of these things, like Manbij and potentially Fallujah, I'm yet to be convinced that these are sustainable for 2-, 3-, 4-year periods. And there are too many opportunities we're giving to exploit the divisions that are already existing in those areas.
Thank you, Charles. Douglas, the question of post-Sistani or any of the others?
Sure. My take on post-Sistani is, you know, take deep breath and don't worry. We know who Sistani's successor is going to be. It's going to be one of the other three grand ayatollahs who are sitting next to him in Najaf as part of this council. There may be a transition period as the three of them jockey for which one of them is going to ascend, but it's going to be one of them. And then, you know, someone over a period of time will come up and become the next generation of grand ayatollahs in Najaf. To me, that's the interesting piece to watch is, you know, these – it's been the same four since we invaded the country in 2003. They're all getting older. The only way this could get really complicated would be if his three potential successors all died before he did, which, of course, is not impossible. That could be a complicated situation. Barring that, it's going to be very simple. One of those will ascend, even if he's just a caretaker for a time, until a younger, more established, more charismatic cleric comes along. But this is not as clean as the Catholic Church does it with the College of Cardinals, you know, white smoke, new pope, everything's great. But there is a process. This is not the first time there has been a secession in Najaf. There's been one before. There will be one after this. They know what they're doing. Conditionality. There is conditionality on the Kurds. I've had these in off-the-record conversations, so I can't talk about exactly what the conditionality is. But there is conditionality on that money. The United States government isn't quite that stupid. On oil, who controls the oil? I mean, the oil minister does. You know, 85% of the oil is produced in the south around Basra. Just as a side point, that, of course, is a significant limitation to Iraqi federalism. I have this conversation with Sunnis and Kurds all the time. You know, well, we'd like a weaker Baghdad, by which you mean a Baghdad that can't take all the Basra oil money and bring it to the center and distribute it to the periphery? No, I didn't think that's what you meant. So, but the oil is very well controlled by Baghdad. In the south, there is good accountability about the oil revenues coming in. We know exactly how much oil is sold. We know exactly how much it is sold for. We know exactly how much is paid to the oil companies, and we know how much of that money goes to Baghdad. Now, once it goes there, it's a black box, and we have no idea what happens. But that's significantly better than what happens in the north. We have no earthly idea how much oil the Kurds sell and what they sell it for and what their expenses are, which is part of the problem in getting an oil deal put together.
Thank you, Douglas. Jessica, any closing comments?
Certainly. I'll just add to the answer concerning the loss of equipment ISIS specifically in this case. I'm more concerned about risk aversion for that scenario than I am about the incidences in which it occurs. That we don't like to see our equipment end up in the hands of ISIS or Al-Qaeda and sometimes decide not to send in equipment, particularly into the Syrian theater. The best way to ensure that the equipment doesn't go into the wrong hands is to influence human to human as well. And I do think in this case that was a part of the strategy. So I really think that we have more gains tactically against ISIS when we do engage despite the risk, and we have more strategic gains against Al-Qaeda in Syria when it comes to demonstrating that we are actually going to be partners to members of the Syrian opposition if we engage. So I would say it's worth the risk.
Thank you, Jessica. Obviously, this will be an issue which will be with us for many months and years. I encourage you to look at our website for upcoming events that I mentioned earlier, and please join me in thanking our excellent panel for today.